And I couldn't think of a better way to spend my birthday than being with you.
Oh, thank you.
Let us go inside and feel within our hearts that there is a glowing light, a warm light, a loving light. Not impersonal in the sense that it's above or beyond you, but very intimate, very personal, very loving, deeply caring about you. And to feel that light grow in your heart and extend out through all of your body so that it goes through all of your efferent and afferent nerves. It goes into your muscular system, your cellular system, into the brain and all of the neurons. If there are any parts of your body that are having difficulties, it can especially saturate all of those places, making them glow in the same kind of light that is glowing in your own heart center. As that light permeates every cell of your body, it naturally expands and grows. And it fills up the room that you are in. You feel that vibrancy, that feeling, that light. And it permeates the walls and the ceiling and the floor, all the people, everything that is in that room. It is a sacred vibration, a sacred feeling that is in you. Go on expanding that light as it fills up your community, touching all the hearts and the minds and every part of your community, bringing joy and light and life, bringing harmony to where there is disharmony, bringing love to where there is hatred and intolerance. Until your entire community is glowing with that light. Then go on expanding that light until it envelops this entire earth, all the world, the atmosphere, and beyond. And you see the earth being saturated with that light, that so many wander in ignorance of it. Nevertheless, it is an ever-present vibration, feeling, experience to all those who have attuned themselves to it. And even those who are not aware of it are somehow touched by that light as you think of it permeating all of this world. Lifting up the consciousness of people everywhere. Allowing people to let go of hatred and intolerance, anger and fear. And instead, they become filled with a positive notion about themselves and about this world. It is a healing prayer for this world. And then go on expanding that light as it stretches out in every direction in this universe until this entire creation with the hundreds of billions of stars, so many Earths, so many planets, so many moons, all of it is saturated with that light and pulsating with that light. And then you see this universe as one of many island universes. And all are floating in a sea of this light. Each one are a bubble within the greater ocean. In your mind's eye, see yourself go beyond all physical creation, which, as Sri Yukteswar talks, is like a tiny little solid basket under the great astral balloon. And you see the astral worlds teeming with light and life. And you are that. And then you see all the astral as just a mere idea, a projection, and the tiny little basket of all Earth's creation. And then it all dissolves into a vast sea of consciousness that is pure being, where you exist. You exist in infinitude. There is no body, no earth, no astral or causal, just pure being. And you are in the stillness of that eternal being. And then you may regain some focus, some attention upon this physical body. And you feel how tiny it is. How little it is in contrast to that vast, expansive spirit. And you can understand your restlessness at times. Your desire to go beyond. And it all exists inside of you. In deepened meditation, you can expand out into the vast, universal infinitude of life. You can know yourself to be truly of that spirit. That is your home. That is your origin. This earthly plane and this little body are simply projections of idea. And then of energy. Energy coalesces into materiality. When it has served its purpose, materiality dissolves back into energy. Energy dissolves into thought, idea. Thought, idea dissolves back into spirit. An easy merging. An easy projection without losing connection with the truth and the reality of who you really are. This is what we're working to realize deeply and profoundly, so that we are never again consumed by the things of this world and of this body. We remember always who and what we truly are. Feel once again the vast expansiveness of spirit. If you have a body idea, it is just an outline of a body, an idea of a body. But you are so much more, so much more. Reading from Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, the triumph of the soul through practice of yoga. And this comes from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 6, verses 5 through 6. And Lord Krishna is speaking to Arjuna. Let man uplift the self, or the ego, by the self. Let the self not be degraded or cast down. Indeed, the self is its own friend, and the self is its own enemy. For him, see, you see here, that yourself, your ego, is either your friend or your enemy. And when you use it for noble purposes, this self, this mind, this ego, then it has an uplifting power about it. When you use it for self-realization, you are fulfilling its highest and best use. But when you use it to just go after the things of the senses, when you use it in a degrading kind of a way, then you are your own worst enemy at that point. And Krishna continues, for him whose self has been conquered by the self, or the soul, with a capital S, and that capital S self is the friend of the self, or the little self, the ego. But verily, the self of the soul behaves inimically as an enemy toward that self which is not subdued. Well, that's kind of a mouthful, isn't it? So let's put it this way. You have a greater self inside of you. It has an intelligence, it has a power. And through that higher self, when you make connection with it, it has all the purity that we associate with higher consciousness. It has pure joy, has pure love, that's untainted by personal ambitions or exclusions that the ego is so prone to do. We think, I want this, I want that, and it makes us exclude other people and other things. Or we think to ourselves, I don't like this person, or I like that person. And so we become exclusive in the way that we think about who we want to associate with. But if we really want the universal vision, then we have to rise up to the self with a capital S and all the virtues that go along with it. One time I was given a vision, and it was of this beautiful lake, this body of water. And in that vision, I saw that the waves were being blown by the wind, and that this connected with the body, that when we are restless in the mind, and we make the breath restless as a result, then the surface of the water is disturbed. And we can't see anything but choppy waves, and this is the way that most of us live this life. We don't see the truth, we don't see the higher reality, because we have not achieved a state of calmness. But when we concentrate upon the breath and deepen meditation, and the breath begins to slow down, then it is like that body of water, that the wind dies down, and then that body of water becomes like a mirror. And in that mirror of water, we can see the mountains that are all around that lake. They naturally reflect. Everything that is up above naturally gets reflected into the water. So the mountains get reflected. The stars, the moon, the sun, everything gets reflected in that flat, stable water. And when your mind becomes like that, so still, so flat, then you see the mountain of your own consciousness, your higher consciousness. You see the stars, those lights that were within your spine and within your brain. You see the moon that is at your solar plexus, and that is your moon of intuition, and that begins to glow. And then you see the sun, and the sun is found at the ajna, the point between the eyebrows. And there you see the great light of God. It's not something that you just try to imagine. It's not like looking out and seeing the sun and the light that's in your room. It's something that glows inside of you, and it purifies you, it lifts you up, and it changes you, it attunes you to it. One time, President Lincoln was sitting with a group of people, and somebody said, let us pray that God is on our side. And Lincoln said, this is the prayer that I like even better. Let us pray that we are on God's side. And it's an interesting distinction, isn't it? In the one, we want God to lend his support to what we want. Now, how do we know if what we want is really what is for the highest good of everybody concerned? But if we say, I pray that I am God's side, then I first must still my mind. I must attune my mind to what divine will wants inside of me. What is true, what is right, what is uplifting. And when I get that, then I keep that attunement to that. And that is my guide. That is what I follow. So it is not asking God to follow us and what we want and lending his support and power and intelligence to that. Rather, we are thinking, what is it that God wants of me? How am I to serve him? In my everyday life, do I serve him? Do I find the means to be able to see him in all the people that I meet? Or am I constantly criticizing this world, constantly finding fault with this person and that, constantly wanting, as Sri Yukteswar would say, chop the heads off of others to make myself taller? It's quite an image, isn't it? Chopping all the heads off of everybody else to make yourself taller. Instead of wanting to grow taller and expand in your own consciousness. So this is what this chapter is speaking of, that the self, the little self, can either be your friend or your enemy. It can help lift you up or it can cast you down. And even higher than that is attuning to your higher self with a capital S. So here's Master's commentary. The physical ego, the act of consciousness in man, should uplift its body-identified self into the unity with the soul, its true nature. It should not allow itself to remain mired in the lowly, delusive strata of the senses and material entanglement. The ego acts as its own best friend when, by meditation and the exercise of its innate soul qualities, it spiritualizes itself and ultimately restores its own true soul nature. Conversely, the physical ego serves as its own worst enemy when, by delusive material behavior, it eclipses its true nature as the ever-blessed soul. When the physical ego, the act of consciousness, has become spiritualized and united to the soul, it is able to keep the intelligence, mind, and senses under control, guided by discriminative wisdom of the soul, i.e., the self or the ego can be conquered by the self with a capital S, or the soul. Then the soul is the friend and the guide and the benefactor of active physical consciousness. So the very thing that oftentimes causes us problems. We wake up in the morning and we start thinking about the day. And there are certain things that we want to do. And we think about that, and we think of it from an ego standpoint. I'm this one person, and I would like to earn more money. I would like to have more friends. I would like to have these certain accomplishments. And I enter into this world, and then I go after those things. Or perhaps I think, I'm a little bit lazy today. I don't want to work so hard. I don't want to do anything. So we avoid having to take any responsibilities for that day. And this is the way that the ego goes about it. But for the God-realized soul, the eyes open in the morning, and you say, good morning, God. How are you today? I'm here to serve you. I'm here to love you. I'm here to be your instrument on earth. What would you have for me today? I'm a wide open book, and perhaps you have schedules, perhaps you have things to do. But you set all of that aside for the moment. You first by making that God contact. Now, God is just simply a name for that innate intelligence and power and love that is in that uplifting self, the capital S. But as Shakespeare says, a rose by any other name is still a rose. It doesn't matter what we call God, as long as we are attuning ourselves to the very highest nature. Now, sometimes people will say to me, why do you use that word God? I like everything that you teach, but I don't like it when you say that. But I say that God is the most powerful word in the English dictionary. And that by abandoning the word God, we abandon all of the history, all of the art, all of everything. Now, the fact that people have misused and abused the name of God down through time should only inspire us to find out what the truth is, what that nature of that divinity is. I have never thought of God as a being who sits in some antiseptic corner of the universe, casting out smotes and smites and making other people bow down to him, and that he's a jealous God and so on and so forth. Really, in so many of the scriptures, God is given the basest kind of motivations many times. They're unworthy of anything that I would call God. God is the supreme consciousness. God is the creator of everything that is. If we go behind the scenes, we see that this material universe is really nothing but that which is made up of energy. So many vibrating atoms and electrons and protons, neutrons, and then you get into the subatomic particles. And it gets to the point where scientists are not able to tell you whether it has mass or whether it's physical or whether it's pure energy or whether even it is just a pure idea, a thought. And so it becomes so rarefied then. But what you absolutely know is that this sense of the physicality of this universe is really a false charade. It is not something that truly exists. It's all tiny vibrating pockets of energy. And then you think, how did this energy coalesce into an earth or into a tree? Or into this human body, or this blood that flows through the vessels, or this electrical energy that flows through the nerves. How does it know to do that? Is it all pure random chance? And when you think about it, you think that's a ludicrous idea, that it could all happen just simply by happenstance. There has to be a creative intelligence that's behind it all. And so if there is a creative intelligence that has created everything, then we go into our own cellular structure. We think, isn't it beautiful? Isn't it wonderful? I remember when God took me into an experience spontaneously in which I experienced myself in my mother's womb. And I remember I could hear her heart beating, and I could hear the blood gurgling and flowing throughout her system. And I liked it where I was. It was cozy. It was a very lovely place to be. And then I thought about coming into this world. And I was reluctant to do so. I knew that there would be some difficult aspects to being born into this life. And I wasn't sure at all that that's something that I wanted. You know, most of us have come from the higher realms before we come into this physical realm. The astral realms, the causal realms, in a few rare instances, pure spiritual realms. And this world is a pretty rough place. It's a training ground, but it's boot camp many times. And we're thrown into this life, and we're given the things that we have learned in previous lifetimes. And some of them are good, and some of them are bad. But as I contemplated coming into this lifetime, I really didn't want to come. I really wanted to stay right where I was. And my mother told me later on, after I had this experience, that I was actually breech born. And that the doctor had been inside of her up to his elbows, she said, getting me turned around. And I could just imagine myself having turned myself and not wanting to come out. But, as things would have it, out I came. And I was born into this world, as we all were. And we think, my goodness, how did I end up here? I think many people had, the idea that I was a stranger in a strange land. I felt like my family really wasn't my family. And later on, when I had an experience, and I remembered my family and my life before I came into this world, and how beautifully attuned they were to higher consciousness. And I realized then that I was comparing my pre-birth family with my birth family. And that's what gave me the feeling that this wasn't my real family, and they didn't really understand me as my family would understand me. And it was very true. It was all very true. But there's a great purpose for being born into this world. And even though we suffer much pain and much difficulty, it all comes with a purpose. And that purpose is to awaken us to the truth of who and what we are in spirit and in God. And some people have a natural attraction to that. They want that. And they strive for it. They come with a kind of purity that is inborn. If you read Master's Autobiography of a Yogi, from his very birth and young childhood, he had this tremendous aspiration to know and realize God. Now, he was fortunate that he was born into a society and into a world and into a family where it was understood that realizing God was, first of all, something that you could do. You didn't have to wait until you died at some later date. You could do it now. And that he was born into a family of Kriyabans. So they had a very definite method by which they could practice meditation and move into that higher realization. And Master was motivated by that. He wanted that. He wanted to run away from his home because he found that he needed his teacher, his guru. And so he's always trying to run away. He was wanting to go to the very highest of spiritual consciousness. And it was something that was just in him. At school, they called him the mad monk. Now, many of us don't want to display our differences because we're afraid of what other people will think or say about us. But Master was unafraid. He wore it proudly. And he wanted to be a monk. He wanted to be a sannyas, a swami. And so he kept aspiring for that and kept moving towards that. And you see that his entire life became dedicated toward that endeavor. Mother's life was somewhat different. She was born and incarnated into this world as an avatar, as a perfected being. But she came as an avataram, and that is a little different way to come in. Because in that case, the individual takes on the identity of being a person, as anybody else would. And they live in this world for a certain amount of time, just as others do, until that moment comes for them to awaken. And then they go through so many experiences, they go through sadhana, and even though that karma that Mother was paying off was not her own, nevertheless, she felt herself to be just like anybody else. In fact, she oftentimes felt that she was perhaps the littlest one, in a spiritual sense. And when Elizabeth Hike met Mother, she said, "Why do you go around always thinking you're the littlest one? You are greater than Yogananda," she said. "You are greater than anyone you have met or ever will meet. Why do you not stand up and say that I am that I am?" You see, that great I am is not ego identity. That is your great self with a capital S identity. That is your universal self. And stand up straight. Proclaim the I Am inside of you. Become that universally realized being. Go beyond all the human limits, all the beliefs that you are just a small person, and come to realize who and what you truly are. This is the greatest adventure that anybody can go on in this life. It has danger. It requires our complete and total commitment. It makes us hone our will as we would any kind of sharpened instrument in order to cut through delusion. The delusion is I am a separate being. The realization comes as I am a universal being. And so this is what you have come to learn. It is why we are born into this body. And it wasn't until I met my great guru that I really came to understand that. I knew that I was in spiritual pain before I had met her. And I felt myself to be cursed at the time. I wondered why other people seemed to be pursuing happiness. Other people seemed to be all right. Why am I in such pain here? And I really wished I could just be like other people. But what at that time I saw as a curse, I now see as a blessing. Because it did not let me rest in this world as I wanted to do. It prodded me. It provoked me. It made me go further, beyond my own will, beyond what I wanted in this world. And that is what grace does. Master continues here in his commentary, "But if the lower ego self has not been thus controlled and persists in keeping the consciousness matter bent, then the soul is the enemy of the ego." This follows the Gita allegory described in chapter 1. Krishna is the soul, is the friend and guide of the spiritual endeavors of the devotee Arjuna, along with the Pandava army of divine qualities. Krishna, the soul, is therefore an enemy and opposer of Duryodhana's Kurava army of materialistic inclinations, which is under the guidance of Bhishma, ego. So, if you are leading a spiritual life, you may have other people in your lives that will ridicule you for meditating or for leading a spiritual life. Oh, why are you doing that? You should be leading a life like everyone else. Oh, you're not drinking? No, you should drink alcohol with us. Oh, you're not smoking dope? No, you should smoke dope with us. And they'll ridicule you. They'll put down your spiritual path and your aspiration to go to God. This is then becomes where your true self, your higher self, the Krishna inside of you, becomes an enemy of the ego within you and those around you. And you'll find yourself in a battle with yourself. A part of yourself doesn't want to surrender, doesn't want to let go, doesn't want to focus on God. And it thinks that it'll perhaps become annihilated, that there won't be anything of pleasure, there won't be anything of interest if you go to God, that perhaps you'll die, you'll disappear. This is the way the ego talks to you. And they are enemies, one with the other. And if you look at the East and the Bhagavad Gita, the symbology is that you're on a battlefield with positive forces on one side and negative forces on the other. And you're ensuing this tremendous battle. And then if you look into the Christian symbology and you see the cross, that the upward pointing memberment of the cross is in the spine, and that's the upward force that's inside of you. That's a spiritual force, the positive force is going upward. Then you see the horizontal cross piece to the cross, and that is the limiting nature of this world. It's what keeps you on this horizontal plane of worldly consciousness. And the upward energy clashes with that cross piece. And that creates the mystical crucifixion inside of you. And that begins at the heart center. That is where the cross piece first happens. Occasionally you'll see crosses, and they actually have three different crossing pieces. The large one, as you normally see with a cross, then a smaller one above that, and even a smaller one above that. And that represents the cross of the material plane. That's the first one. The second one is of the astral. And the third one is of the causal. You will see representations of the Buddha. And the Buddha will have what looks like coiled hair going up above his head. But actually, those are representations of the three bodies, the physical, the astral, and the causal. And you'll see one large ring on top of his head, and that represents the physical. You'll see then next a smaller ring, and that's the astral, and then third is the causal. And then above that, you'll see an upward pointing spear. And that is transcending all three bodies and going into pure spiritual consciousness. You see, these symbols from all over the world all are telling the same story. They go by different names according to the language of the area where it was created. But the symbols tell the story. And when you are in the Catholic Church, you will see the 14 stations of the cross. And this is telling of the 14 or the 7 chakras multiplied by 2 and how you are in this upward ascent and how at each one of these you meet a station of the cross. So this is a terrific thing, you see. It's a wonderful thing when we really understand it. It's confounding when it's in the hands of ignorance, because many false statements are said about it, but this does not discount the original Christianity that came into this world. This is what Mother and Master came to bring back, is original Christianity, that which was taught in the first few hundred years. And it was lost. It was lost because we are entering into a material age, into the Kali Yuga. And those symbols that were meant to be transcendent became concretized, fixed features, so that the Christ became a single human being who lived 2,000 years ago, rather than the spiritual consciousness right within your own being, to be found at the point between the eyebrows, the great light of Christ there, that all the disciples where the 6 different chakras going up, and each chakra has a polarity, a positive and a negative, and this made up the 12 disciples. And then Christ was the 13th at the ajna, the point between the eyebrows. And then God the Father, that the Christ worshipped, is up at the top of the head, the Sahasrara, the crown chakra. It all exists right inside of you. All the teachings are there, intended to liberate you. And instead, what we were sold was a story that when you die, then you get the answers, then you get to go to heaven. But Jesus said in the Bible, the kingdom, God and the kingdom of heaven are within you. They are within you. And therefore, all of these things are all within you. This is a tremendous shift of perspective, that you begin to honor the potentiality of what exists right inside of you. Now, it may be dormant. It may be unrealized at this point. You may get glimpses of it here and there, and then fall back into separation and ignorance. But it does not deny the truth of what is being said, that God and the kingdom of heaven are within you. That to those who were in the inner circle was given the truth and all others in parable. You are being given the truth. You are being given the inner reality. And you can take that truth. You can take that reality and you can put it to work inside of you. And this is what happened in my own journey with my own guru. She gave me the tools, but she couldn't do it for me. She gave me the grace and the power so greatly of everything of God inside of her. And yet I had to do the work. I could not just sit on my hands and hope that my life would change. I had to make the right decisions, step by step. And if I made wrong decisions, and I did make wrong decisions, then I suffered the consequences. But that's how I learned. And I learned that what she taught me was the truth, that every single thought is a creation. And if you don't master your thoughts, you're never going to become a spiritual master. It will never happen. And we begin right where we are. We start to focus on the most beautiful, the highest, that which has the most light. And we let go of the things that degrade us, that pull us down. Now your mind, the ego mind, can be your friend or it can be your enemy. And the other lesson we get from these teachings is that when we're identified with the lower mind, it feels like the higher mind, the purity inside of us, is our enemy. And we want to get rid of it. We want to deny it, even as the disciples denied the Christ. And when we do this, we cause ourselves the most pain, the most suffering. Because when we are taken down into the depths, then we realize what we have done. And we so deeply regret it, so deeply regret it. But it is in this way that we learn wisdom. We learn how to be our own best friend. We learn that when we go inside and we become aware of what the inner light is telling us, how it is directing us, that we must obey it, not out of some servitude, but we realize that when we don't, we suffer, we pay the price. And when we listen to that higher light and go with it, then we feel closer, we feel drawn up. And we feel aligned with that divine presence and light and intelligence. And in that sense, it's not difficult. Are we focused up or are we focused down? Are we increasing our life or are we degrading our life? And you know, the sad thing is, we usually know when we're going in the wrong direction. And we do it anyway. We do it with some idea that we're somehow going to beat the game, that we're not going to have to pay the price. We're going to be able to get away with it. I remember times when I felt so God so greatly inside of me. I felt His bliss. I felt His joy, and it's just ongoing. And then I would do something, and something in the back of my mind would tell me, that's not quite right. But I would still continue feeling that bliss and upliftment. And I'd think, well, it's all right. Little did I realize that by making that little decision, I was veering off of the path. And there is a certain momentum that came with the spiritual upliftment, the bliss that I was feeling, the peace that I was feeling. And it carried along with me, even though I was going and veering off and going more and more in the wrong direction, but feeling like I was getting away with it. And then suddenly everything would collapse, everything would fall down, because I had been going in the wrong direction. And I realized I created this. I did this. I was not my own best friend. I was my own worst enemy. But you see, in some degree, I had to go through that so that I could really learn down to the cellular level, the truth that every thought is a creation. And I had to master that thought. I had to focus in the right way. Now, when you realize that going in the wrong direction and being an enemy to spirit within you creates so much suffering, then it becomes your own best self-interest. You're not being munificent. You're not being benign by going with God's will. You are doing something that is in your own best self-interest. It will bring you the greatest amount of happiness, lasting happiness, not just for a little bit, but something that goes on and on. It's the thing about God realization. That which is born inside of you, that bliss, that joy, that light, that peace, it doesn't end. It is eternal. And because of that, you will always enjoy that ever new joy. And it is ever new. It's not something you get tired of. I remember thinking one time, as I was feeling the bliss of God, will I get tired of this? Will I, like a toy that a child gets, and it's just absolutely obsessed with that toy for a little while, and then suddenly that toy is left out in the rain, and it's getting soaked, and it's getting rusted. And then the child is off on to the next thing. And that's the way the pleasures are for the human self. And so it's natural to think, well, maybe I just get tired of God. But you know what? For these many years, I've never once gotten tired of God. I've never gotten to the point where I thought, I have enough of this. Quite the opposite. The further I go, the more that I want. And the more that I want, the further I go. It's an amazing thing, and it runs contrary to everything that we learned about happiness in this world. Because there truly is ever new, it's ever fresh. And it almost confounds the mind when it really bumps up against that, and it tests it. It tests it to see whether it is the truth. And then you realize that it is. So let me ask you tonight to be your own best friend. And by that I mean, dedicate yourself to a higher life, a life of purity, of spirituality, of universal love, and a vision that encompasses everyone as a part of yourself. And you are part of everyone else. It's a magnificent vision. And I can tell you, without qualification, that in attaining that high vision, you will never be disappointed. You will never tire of it. But it will be beguiling to you, enthralling, thrilling, enlightening, illuminating you. Everything good and everything true, you will realize within your own self. I love that we have shared this time tonight. And I see you in my mind's eye and see you filled with that light, that love, that joy. It is my greatest wish. And if I could give to you a gift tonight, it would be that you feel inspired to seek out that divinity within yourself, to know yourself to be that divine being, that which you respect in the world of spirituality, whether it is Jesus or Krishna or Buddha or any of those who are reverential, that they all exist inside of you. and that you were born in order to realize them. My blessings to you, I pranam to you, bow to the light within you. And let us do this again. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Ram. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Ram.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a lovely day. Hari Om. Oh, did I start this?